Tape session number 32510, Reel 1.
Jack Reynolds, Reel 1. Jack, can you tell me where and when you were born, please?
I was born in Chittister on the 10th of May, 1922.
And can you tell me about your family?
My father owned a high-class gentleman's outfitter, Jaeger, Burberry, that sort of standard. And both my parents were Sussex-born and bred for generations, and both Sicestrians, as you say, Chichester people. And the family were either farmers or trade. Extraordinary mixture, but we had quite a number of farming members of the family. So I grew up visiting a lot of farms and knowing all about animals, and it was all horse drawn, of course. I'm going back before the war, where even the corporation dust carts were horse drawn in Chichester. It was a different era entirely. We didn't have a car in the family. Only one rather wealthy uncle in Bognor had a car, and I disgraced myself by everybody else taking on it being sick, so I wasn't allowed on that car even. But it was a very normal tradesman's background, and in Chichester you were either an artisan, a tradesman, a professional, or as they were known, as the gentry, and you knew your place. You made your friends within that group, and I was brought up very strictly, church three times on Sunday, choir boy, and I went to work eventually, 15 shillings a week, at the local gasworks, because I turned down the job my father found for me at W.H. Smith's, because I wouldn't sell penny balls in Bognor, I said. 15, and I graduated to the West Sussex County Council at £1 a week, and finished up at the princely sum of 30 shillings a week, which was equivalent to almost to a farm labourer's pay, although he got perks, of course. And that was my upbringing, really. It was strictly very, very narrow.
What about your education?
I was educated just at high school for boys. I got my Oxford school certificate with matriculation, but I was sports mad. I played cricket and football. I got my colours for the cricket and football for the school. And at 16, I was playing for Chichester City First 11 in the Sussex County League. But that was a passing phase, because, of course, in March 1939, I joined the Territorials. My brother was already a member. I was only 16, but I put my age on. The medical was very simple. If you're warm, you're in. It was just as easy as that.
Were you aware of the situation in Europe at that time?
Yes. Yes, we were, because, of course, my father, being the First World War, he was invalided out after Gallipoli. Unfortunately, I never expressed much interest in what happened. I wish I had now, but that was the way it was. It was only 20 years before another war, of course, or just 21 years, so that I missed out on that. But, yes, I was aware, and, of course, at 16, there was a certain glamour about being in uniform, and I have a wonderful picture of myself at 16, standing with my brother, and good heavens, I could have been in the choir still. I looked that young. I was, of course.
At that time as well, it was getting to the time really of Munich and that sort of thing. Were you aware of the kind of politics as well?
Yes,
that was kind of going on?
My parents were very much of the opinion that we should know and be brought into the picture and be aware that there could be another war. It didn't come as a surprise, because we were, in a way, sort of trained to think that way, to prepare for ourselves for another disaster. But I must admit that wasn't the reason I joined. It wasn't patriotic reasons, it was the glamour. I'll be perfectly honest, they waved the flag and banged the drum, and I followed.
How did you go about joining the Territorials? Was there a procedure?
I just accompanied my brother to one of their weekly drill sessions and was introduced. And as far as I remember, it was a very simple matter of meeting the regular drill sergeant, who was the recruiting sergeant too, of course, and being asked certain questions of a very simple nature, and then being invited to join, subject to medical, which, as I say, was a farce.
Why was that? Was it a very simple medical?
Well, I say, if you're warm, you're in. We had people in that yeomanry regiment who should never have been in the army at all. They were not lame, but they limped. A friend of mine was in who limped, and one or two had terrible eyesight. They would never have passed a normal army test, but they were desperate. The writing was on the wall then, of course, 39. It's pretty obvious.
How did you... what did you do when you attended the kind of weekly drill?
Well, I opted to be a signaller from the word go, because my brother was a signaller. And so I didn't take part in any gun drill. I went straight on to Morse classes and Morse procedures, which was the essential thing, a landline for Morse. And I became, of course, at 16, it was easy. It was so simple as like falling off a log. I mean, we would sit listening to the Morse being relayed by the sergeant, and we had a final test to pass out as qualified. And I remember it was what he recited was, "Down in the river by Nitty Itty Pool swam three little fishes and a mamma fishy too." Then he altered the words, of course, being clever, but I suspected he was going to do it, and I got it all right, so I passed out with flying colours. But it was incredibly easy, like it is for a young scout to learn Morse. There was nothing clever about it.
And would you receive that as a weekly instruction while you were doing
that? Yes, every week we went, rigged as clockwork, and we carried a little swagger stick under our arm. They had been mechanised. They were a 25-pounder battery, 18-pounder originally, and then they got 25-pounders. And they kidded me that on church parade I would have to be the boy trumpeter riding behind the colonel. And I was terrified. But of course it was all nonsense. And I went to camp at Oakhampton in August, where cider was penny a pint rough, tuppence a pint sweet. I didn't drink. I didn't have a drink till I was commissioned, my 19th birthday. But I remember the chap stumbling back up the goat track, legless, almost scrumpy. But that we left, came back from the camp and mobilised straight away, virtually.
With the camp, how long was the camp for?
I think it was only a week. Colonel Clements was our colonel. Because, of course, with the Sussex Yeomanry, they were divided later into two lines, and Cowdery was one of the officers in that. And Lord North, we had some of the aristocracy floating around.
So were the officers, as you mentioned, the kind of local gentry who would go into a local yeomanry?
That was generally the idea. You didn't get any jumped up to wartime commissions like I was later. I mean, there was none of that. There was aping your betters. No, they were true. And in the main, they were pretty good. They were competent. They weren't just chinless wonders. They were in it because they wanted to do a job. And of course, a lot of the officers you met were First World War, because they were all First World War nearly, because it was only 20 years, and if they'd gone in at an early age, they were still around about 40 or something.
What activities were you involved in at the camp?
Signal practice. That was all, really.
Was the battery operating as a battery?
Yes, oh, very much so, yes. And it went on till we were mobilised.
Were you mobilised before the outbreak of war?
2 days, I think, that's all. And I was so ignorant of drill that when I turned out, it was in... They took over the Young Women's Christian Association buildings in North Pallant, Chichester. And when they turned out the guard, I was one of the guard, and I turned out. And The officer inspecting came along and he gently removed my rifle and put it on the correct shoulder. Didn't say a word. But that was how little... I'd never fired a shot from that rifle at all. It was some time before I was in that, but that was how our basic training was in what we had to do. Drill was at a discount completely. And quite rightly so, too, because they wanted to make gunners rather than square bashers, and fair enough. And they were efficient battery. But we were mobilised and war broke out and we were sent to the Sussex County Career Ground at Hove.
How had you been informed of your mobilisation?
I have no idea. I think they must have sent us papers of some sort, but I haven't any record of them. But they may not have done, being in Chichester, they may have picked up a phone and said, come on, get your uniform, you're in. But I really don't know. I can't remember that far back.
What uniform did you have at the time?
I'll show you. It was a khaki. The uniform was actually very poor quality, khaki, very uncomfortable. It was either made to fit small, fat people or tall, thin people. And in between, you had to hoist it up on army-issue braces. We wore a leather belt in yeomanry style, collar dogs and a lanyard to indicate which section of the battery you were in. The older members wore peak caps. But I had one of the new forage caps, which are ghastly things. Whoever designed them never had to wear them seriously. They blew off, and there was a method of strapping them under your chin, I believe, if you let something down, which you looked like a refugee, no less. We had the Sussex Yeomanry collar dogs and the Sussex Yeomanry badge. It was the Surrey and Sussex Yeomanry. But the Chichester battery and the Brighton battery, and I think there was one other, but I was only interested in the Chichester battery, of course. But the uniform itself, we had boots, which are very uncomfortable, issued with a pay book, of course, which we duly presented when required. But the uniform was First World War, of course. I mean, this is what one's all dealing with. It came out of store, hurriedly. And we also had breeches, putties, and spurs. Although we dropped the spurs eventually. But we had that uniform, and I kept my jodhpurs. And later on, when I was down Dover, I used to wear them because they're wonderful protection with gum boots, Wellingtons, in the spray. But that was our uniform, together with a swagger stick, as I say, which you had to carry at all times. It's ridiculous.
We left off the narrative when you'd just been sent to the cricket ground at Hove.
When we got to the cricket ground at Hove, and we continued immediately with our training for signalling or whatever we were doing. It was no drill. The centrepiece was a pavilion which around everything, and there were various bits and pieces around the edges which were used as offices and things like that. And we were in private billets. I was with a naturalised German, strangely enough. And I do remember when we had a practice call-out, hearing an ex-regular thump on the door and say those immortal words, "Open in the name of the military," which I thought was wonderful. But our training went on until the late autumn, when the battery was mobilised for Egypt and, of course, the Western Desert. I was an immature, so I was left behind. And I was posted to various holding units for immatures, including a remarkable one with the immatures from the London Rifle Brigade, who were all East End Cockneys, sort of barrel boys. And it broadened my vocabulary considerably, I can say, being with them. And then eventually I was posted to Grain Island area on searchlights.
When was that?
That was just before the winter of 39. And I drifted around from battery to battery as a signaller.
What was your role within the battery?
Well, you were doing emergency Morse in case the telephones broke down, that sort of thing, or use the telephones. You weren't even signalling, but that was your job. And I went from them. I seem to remember I even finished up for a brief time on Southend Pier. But it was a very short period. Anyway, I was then posted as a signaller to Mumbles in South Wales, which was the battery of 4.7 guns, two of them, I think there were, if I remember, yes. They covered the entrance to Swansea Harbour, and every vessel entering had to be stopped and searched. And we were in contact with the vessels doing it, or even went on the vessels. And
how would you feel, obviously, about not being able to go with all your comrades in the Yeomanry?
Oh, I was very browsed off indeed. Very fed up. Of course, at that stage, my mother could have got me out of the army. But, I mean, she wouldn't do that. I know she wouldn't, but it could have happened. But I was with other immatures, so it wasn't as bad as it might have been. And I say we drifted around from unit to unit until they found places for us. They were rather embarrassed with us, I think, at that stage. And they wanted real soldiers.
Essentially, you really kind of at a loose end as to what your role was going to be and how you were going to...
No, I never occurred to me I was in the army and I did what they said. I simply had no imagination at all about that sort of thing. Throughout my army career, I lacked a certain amount of imagination as to the consequences of what was happening or what might happen. And I was footloose and fancy-free. I was just 17. I had no girlfriend or anything like that. And at that age, you're welcome being away from home, which is not a good thing to say necessarily, but it's true, I think. You youngsters do like to get up and go.
And the battery at Mumbles,
yes.
Was it again another searchlight battery?
No, it was 4.7 guns. They were taken off the old destroyers, mounted for coast defence, on an island. And at high tide, low tide, you walk across the causeway. At high tide, we had to row ashore for supplies. And it was all rather amusing.
Had that been hurriedly done to mount
a
defence?
No, it was an established territorial unit. And I was a signaller there, one of two or three, I think, but... I progressed very rapidly. I learned semaphore, the Aldous lamp, Morse of the flag, as well as the normal signalling jobs, and I became a bombardier, two stripes at 18. Well, this was all very well, but I was instructing reservists and 42-year-olds and things like that. And they rapidly came to the conclusion that in the spring of 40, I was posted in Mumbles. In the spring, I was, early spring, I was told I should apply for a commission.
I take it with that then, you'd obviously adjusted quite well to army life.
Oh, and the fact that you were completely institutionalised, yes, there was no shadow of doubt. It was my life. And I had no thoughts of what I had done in Civvy Street or going back to a job in Civvy Street or anything like that. I was in the army for the duration and I was going to go along with it. I wasn't ambitious because that way is trouble in the army. If you either tread on people's faces on the way up and they tread on yours on the way down. So I just jogged along. As I say, I was a bombardier, and then that became a slightly embarrassing all size, and I realised that. So I went for... I applied for a commission in the usual way. Well, to do that, you have to have an interview before you're accepted for OCTU. And it would be coast defence I would be in, probably, certainly artillery, because I was a gunner by trade.
Had you been at Mumbles then through 40 all the way into 41?
Well, not, so from 40, yes, I must have been. I was there quite a long time, I know. And we had a call out, an emergency call out for a suspected church bell ringing, you know, alarm. And I remember being sent to this very rocky little point with another chap, a rifle and 5 rounds of ammunition. And I thought, we can put up a very stout defence here with this. But, yes, I was. It was in 41 that, in the early spring, that I was interviewed for and told that, you know, if you want to go to a formal interview for a commission.
Had you witnessed any of the kind of German air attacks on the Swansea area?
There was one amusing incident. Our command post was attached to the lighthouse on the island, because, of course, there was a lighthouse there. And a bomber came over low one night to drop mines in the harbour. And I was duty signaller. And I saw this thing, and we had a Bren gun mounted in the forecourt between us and the guns. So I thought, well, this is a chance, Reynolds, to show yourself as a true hero. So I rushed out and fired at the guy who was past me, going over, but very low. I saw the tracer bullets, 1 in 3, falling short. And I thought, oh. And then something happened that wasn't in the book. The rear gunner fired back at me. Now, this was most unexpected. It was a sandbagged thing I was firing in, of course. I just ducked, and then I heard a stream of filthy language from the command post where the RSM, Adams, Donkey Adams, as he was called, I wouldn't say he was slumbering, but he was meditating, shall we say. He suddenly was subjected to a, not quite close by, a hail of bullets from this aircraft. What he called me, it was not pleasant for a little while. But that was my first encounter with the enemy. As I say, it wasn't very heroic at all. It was, in retrospect, rather amusing. He was a regular, of course. Reservist called back.
With the organisation on the headland there, you were on the island, weren't you? How does the command post relate to the various gun positions?
Well, there are only 2 gun positions. They were on the island, and the whole centre of the thing was the island. The main body slept, because of course you did tours, you know, on and off. So. But the rest of them just were on the mainland. You landed at the pier, and then there was the cookhouse and everything else, and the medical facilities and that sort of thing. They were just all grouped there. It was a fairly rough and ready. It was a Welsh territory unit.
Again, is that useful, though, to adjusting to the kind of people you meet in the army from all different backgrounds?
Well, I'd already met some. Yes, it certainly was, because I met quite a number of reservists, crafty old devils. You know, I was a bombardier, and there was one chap, Nye Bevan, not the Nye Bevan, but Nye Bevan, who was a reservist, and he used to borrow money from me every Thursday or Wednesday. I was strictly, you weren't supposed to lend it as an NCO to a gunner. But Pavey Mac, absolutely religiously, every Friday, when he got his pay, he'd pay it back. We had quite an understanding over this. That was old Nye. Remember, he was a true Welshman, though. But I got on all right with them. They, you know, I think because of my age, really, they might have objected to having a more older man, Englishman, down there, because they were intensely Welsh. But I got on all right, and the Welsh... And the ladies, the ATS, they were all very pleasant. No, it was all, even the medical orderly was Welsh. I remember getting dermatitis down there. Because when you came off duty, you slipped into the blankets of the chap who's gone on, because it was so crowded. Of course, inevitably. But they were really treating me with some violent, coloured, mauve treatment. I walked around with a bandage around here, looking like a slightly like a young Father Christmas, I think, for a little while, but it was all one of those things you did, you know, when you were in the army, for part and parcel. It never worried me. I never felt inconvenienced or hardships, because it was basically you were fed and you were undercover when you slept, and the rest of it was army routine.
And at that age, are you quite resilient to changes?
Of course you are. You take it all in your stride, and it was all a bit of an adventure still, I must admit. So I stayed there until I went up, and I was interviewed by three elderly gentlemen, ex-military. I think they'd been brigadiers at least. And I went in for this interview, and the first question the chairman asked me was, "Do you hunt, boy?" And luckily I had the quick wit to say, "Only on foot, sir." And the second question was, "What paper do you read?" Again, the Daily Telegraph, sir. Of course I didn't. And no way did I. I'd never opened the Daily Telegraph in my life. And the third one said, "Good God, this boy's been soldiering since the outbreak of war." And as far as I know, that was my interview. And I went to Plymouth on Octo shortly afterwards.
When you turned up at Plymouth, was there again a kind of induction procedure that you have?
We walked straight into the Blitz. My 2 months at Plymouth coincided with the Blitz. We were rushed into Blitz and almost immediately out digging out, or helping to dig out and that sort of thing. We did our training, but it was done in the hours when the sirens went on. And I did 2 months there, and it was pretty awful. It was my first real encounter with death, violent death, and there was a lot of it. I remember going on duty, what it must have been a nursing home, and the first thing I came across was a mother dead with a baby, and then a dead nurse. And there was one particular building we were working on, we could hear them rapping, tapping, and the sirens went, and of course we were recalled then, you didn't work to the sirens. When the sirens stopped and went back, and then another direct hit, so we failed to get them out. It was quite an experience from my point of view. It was without being in actual warfare as such, it toughened you up a bit, I'm sure of that.
Were you attached to the civil defence?
No, we were operating entirely on our own. The army operated separately.
Had you been given any training in kind
no,
of rescue
not at all. No, I was a gunner, purely, but you adapted very, very quickly. Except for one officer, they were pulling down a wall that was dangerous, and he got a big cable rope round this thing, attached it to the rear axle of the lorry, and told the driver to drive off, and he left the rear axle there, and the lorry went. I remember that pompous little man he was. That was amusing. But basically we had no training. We adapted very quickly. I mean, you're given a pick and shovel, and you know what you've got to do. You've got to move the rubble and get at them to try and get them out if they're there.
And you mentioned the rapping. Could you hear people
yes,
under
it? We heard these. It was the only time I ever heard it, but they were in some sort of shelter underneath or in some way protected. But no, it was bad.
What was the kind of devastation on Plymouth like?
Oh, dreadful. It was, yes. I mean, Plymouth suffered very badly indeed. We were... the Citadel was where our headquarters was, right on the front, overlooking the water. And we were stationed in this little building, and you could hear the bombs whistle by and explode in the water. How far away they were, I don't know. And of course, you must remember, the bombs were relatively small in those days. That if you heard them coming, you were in the open, you laid flat and they exploded a reasonable distance away, you weren't hurt. They stepped up the size of the bombs, of course, but originally it was the amount of the bombs that did it, and the fact that you had not been sent to it. They burnt the church opposite us, because the vicar would not let us hack the organ out, because the incendiary was behind the organ. Well, of course, it went up like a... So he had a burnt-out church.
How often were the raids coming in that two-month period?
Oh, I can't tell you, but it seemed every third or fourth night, you know, something like it. But I may be wrong there. I do know I came back to my billets one night after the raid had finished, and I found the door of my bedroom blown off and laying across the bed. It struck me as being funny. I don't know why. I mean, it never occurred to me I'd had a fairly narrow escape. But I say no imagination. It was trouble. Well, the advantage.
I was going to say, is that an advantage in that kind of...
Well, I found it all my army life an advantage, yes. People dwelt on what might happen and could happen and worried themselves to death before they even got on the plane, let alone dropped or whatever they did.